On behalf of the Lands Department, I wanted to welcome you to our first Zoom meeting and a presentation on the land code and our ticketing enforcement law. Before we get started, I'm going to put a couple of people on the spot and ask if they could do an opening prayer for us. I'm looking at Leona Antoine or William Sandy. Could I get a volunteer to do an opening prayer, please?
I can say a prayer, Stephen.
Perfect. Thank you.
This is Zalman Jute's creation prayer. Tutlua tu wago, dakam akwamek ntlago, che lwi haidem, exkandation ea exotokt, tutla go, tutla wishdashkom, dakam akwamek nea, we haidem exkandash, che ea dixilkt, dakam hamamoik, dakam hasha ab, Dakam hashialikin atlimushalikin dats buz pazu. We haidam chael exotokten ea dixilkt. Da halo, da ziwi, da squench dish hawel, da scourish dish dakam hashquanocht, da scourish dish dakam dagisht, we chael haidam, kandeshash dakam exotokt, ne ea dictimucht, homel.
Thank you, William. To start us off, I wanted to just go over a few housekeeping items. We're going to roll through a couple of presentations tonight, and we want to people to hold their questions and comments until each presentation is finished. If there's any sort of feedback or noise coming from someone, we'll likely be muting you just on an interim basis, if possible. We want just to make sure that everyone has a chance to see the presentation and hear what the presenters are speaking about clearly. Before we get into the presentation, I wanted to introduce our staff members that are on, or I'll start by introducing myself, and this other staff members can introduce themselves. Then we'll go into our guests that are here that support the Lands Department and our projects, and then so we can get a good idea of who's participating in the Zoom meeting. We wanted to verify participants by having people introduce themselves, their name. So I'll start off. My name is Stephen Jimmy. I'm the Director of Lands for LNIB. I've been working with LNIB for getting close to 3 years now. I started off as the Lands Manager, then moved up to the Director within this last year. With that, I'll hand it over to my teammates that are on the call and let them introduce themselves.
My name is Randy O'Flynn. I'm the Lands Manager for the Lower Nicola Indian Band. I've been working for LNIB for just over 6 years now. I've been in the manager's position for about a year and a half, and prior to that, I was the Lands Agent. I'll hand it over to Christopher Poor.
I'm the Lands Researcher. I have been with Lower Nicola just since April here, and I've been working on some of the projects that they're going to discuss tonight, and then helping out a lot with organization of things.
Thank you, Chris. We have a guest from the First Nation Land Management Resource Center. Sean, could you just introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Stephen, for the invitation. My name is Sean Spears. I'm with the First Nations Lands Management Resource Center. And we provide supports to communities across Canada who are developing or implementing land codes. Thanks.
Thank you, Sean. Up next, there's two guests from Land Forest People Consulting, David and Lindsay. Could you just do a quick introduction?
Good evening. My name is David Carson. I'm principal at Land Forest People Consulting. I'm pleased to be with you tonight. I want to thank Lower Nicola for all the confidence you have given in having us work with you. It's an honor, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight.
And I'm Lindsay Hutchinson, also with Land Forest People. I've had the pleasure of working with Lower Nicola for just about 2 years now on a few different projects. And so we work a lot on lands governance and resource governance, policy work, things like that. And also pleased to be here tonight with everybody.
And thank you, David and Lindsay. I think that is all of our project team members. And perhaps we can just go through the other participants on the call just to announce your name. And then we'll roll on to the next one after that. If we could start now, please participants and guests, announce your name.
Geraldine Bangham.
Leona Antoine.
Ashman Peterson.
Bonna Moses.
Monica Pettinger.
Yedek Shidish, Tatin Squash, Sandy, council member.
Rose Behan.
Hey, thanks everyone. I think we can move on. Just again, I would like to encourage everybody to keep their phones, their computers on mute while we're presenting, just so we can make sure that everyone who's participating in this Zoom meeting has a good chance to hearing the presenters. Thank you. I'm going to start off with a presentation on the land code. And I just wanted to start us off with that because I'm not sure if everybody is aware of what a land code is and whether, or I guess what it contains and what it's meant to do. So again, unfortunately, it doesn't look like our LMAC chair, Bill Bowles, was able to get on. Thanks again, William, for doing our prayer. So the presentation that we're going to run through today is going to start off with some background information on the land code, some key highlights that come out of the land code, and then I'm going to hand over the presentation to Lindsay Hutchinson from Land Forest People. She's going to walk us through the ticketing and enforcement law presentation, and then the ticketing and enforcement law implementation process. And when it comes to a specific scenario, and the scenario we'll pick today is illegal dumping. We're going to run through three presentations, and after each presentation, we're going to open it up for questions. So I'd ask everyone to please just hold your questions and comments until each presentation is over, then we'll give everybody plenty of time to comment. So first question is, what is a land code? And I'll walk through some of those details. So first thing first, I wanted to just let you know what a land code is, right? And a land code is an expression of self-government, right? It's a way of LNIB pursuing the goal of self-government, and this is the first step, right? The land code is a law that was created by LNIB, right? And it also is a law that replaces the land management sections of the Indian Act. It also removes the Government of Canada from reserve land management. And you may ask yourself, why do we have a land code? And there's a couple of points I'd like to tell you. The land code helps us with, LNIB with, cultural heritage protection, funding for land management and administration. It helps LNIB with setting up economic development. And it's another tool that we can use to help enforce land laws on reserve. And I wanted to also let you know like what a land code is not, right? A land code is not a treaty, right? And a land code is not a land claim settlement. Land code does not affect Aboriginal rights and title. It does not affect territories outside of reserve land. It does not affect status, Indian status. It does not affect taxation. It does not affect programs and services already being delivered by LNIB. And it doesn't affect programs delivered by other government organizations. An example that I give you is the First Nation Health Authority. So just to sum it all up in one slide, really what land code does for us, it helps us step away from the federal government. The federal government is no longer involved in managing reserve lands, right? And it means that Indigenous and Northern Affairs Canada aren't involved in our decision-making process when it comes to land management, environmental management, and natural resources. No more INAC, no more Indigenous Services Canada, Indian and Northern Affairs Canada. They're out of the picture when it comes to land management decisions now. And I also wanted to highlight the fact that the Lower Nicola Indian Band is not the only First Nation that is pursuing a land code and pursuing the implementation of one, right? And this is a little snapshot that I pulled out of the Lands Advisory Board annual report, right? And there was, as of a few months ago anyway, 95 other First Nations that have ratified a land code. There are a number of First Nations that are also actively pursuing the development and ratification of the land code. There's also a number that are interested in pursuing that, right? And there's a handful of First Nations that are just inactive for whatever reason. So there's 1 in 3 First Nations in Canada that are involved in the framework agreement as signatories or interested communities. And I wanted to touch on what I mean by the framework agreement first before we go on. So the framework agreement on First Nation land management is a government-to-government agreement established by the Lands Advisory Board a number of years ago. And what that means is the framework agreement opens the door for every First Nation in Canada to consider and to walk into, if they want to, this sort of sectoral self-governance process. It allows every First Nation in Canada to consider whether or not they want to be governing their own lands, resources, environment, and natural resources, right? And as of December 1st, 2016, the Lower Nicola Indian Band has ratified a land code, and it became operational or in effect on December 1st, 2016. Just a fun fact I thought I would throw in there. Again, it's from content from the Resource Center, the Lands Advisory Board. And again, last fiscal year, there was 12 new signatories to the framework agreement. And point of note, you should see Shaq Indian Band, one of our neighbors, has actually joined the pursuit of this self-governance process. The Lands Advisory Board mission statement, I wanted to throw this in there also, it's First Nations working together to resume jurisdiction over reserve land, environment, and natural resources. Right, this is a nationwide initiative, and there's several First Nations that are pursuing this goal towards self-governance. So there are a number of benefits of being under a land code, and I just wanted to highlight a couple of them. First one here is that the chief and council are accountable to its members on how they collect and spend money from reserve land activity. What this really means is council reports to the community and not Indigenous Services Canada. Also, our laws will protect our precious cultural and heritage resources. What this also means is that we can designate certain lands through our own process as protected and ensure there is no disturbance or development on them if we choose so. Our land code is actually a federal law under the framework agreement. And what this also means is that the courts will have to enforce our laws that we develop, including the land code. We are now one step closer, like I said earlier, to self-government, right? We are building our capacity to govern ourselves over land and resources and closer, I'll say, to full self-government than we were before the land code came into effect. So these are some highlights from the land code itself. And I'm not going to spend too much time on them, but I did want to give you an idea of what the sections of this law include. So section one is the preliminary matters. It's where the housekeeping section is of the land code that provides like legal definitions. It asserts LNIB's authority to govern. It also is where the reserves are defined that are subject to the land code and the jurisdiction LNIB acquired with it. Section two, LNIB legislation. This is the section that describes how LNIB will go about making its laws to govern our reserve lands and resources. This section also includes provisions that speak to the lawmaking powers of council, the lawmaking procedure, and also how LNIB is going to incorporate community input when laws are considered for ratification. Section three, community engagement and approval. This is how LNIB will ensure that community engagement happens in a way that is fair and accessible to all LNIB members, right? There's a requirement to do a public hearing process. There's also a requirement for community approval and for specific matters under the land code. And it also describes how the land code itself would have been ratified or has been ratified back in 2016. Section four touches on interests and licenses and land. And this is really the way that individual people, members and non-members, can have legal interests in land, LNIB land, reserve land, and the right to use parcels of land. It's also considered a license in the land. Right, so this section touches on CPs, certificate of possessions, leases, easements, and permits. So interests are the three top. An interest is a CP or an allotment. It's also a lease, and an interest also is also an easement. A permit is more like a license, or it is a license. So it's a lesser granting to members and non-members, and really just gives someone a right to use the land, not an interest in the land itself. Section 5, protection of land. This section is a key one, right? And it describes how LNIB is going to ensure that our reserve lands and resources remain ours and under our control. So there's provisions in this section that prevent expropriation by other governments. And what I mean by that is it prevents or limits the federal and provincial government's ability to expropriate land. It protects LNIB's land base. There's also a section in this section 5, there's a provision that deals with land exchange or the process associated with the land exchange, assuming that LNIB wanted to exchange land for whatever reason. Section 6 deals with land administration, and this is the what we're calling the nuts and bolts of how land would be managed day to day now that the federal government or Canada is no longer administering our lands. This is also part of the governance section. I think of it as the part of the governance structure. This is where the creation of the Lands Management Advisory Committee is, or LMAC. We have a committee that meets on a regular basis, almost every 2 weeks. And we have sometimes lengthy meetings and discussions about lands issues. It deals with the composition of the Lands Management Advisory Committee, and it also describes the responsibility of that committee itself also. Section 7 is about accountability. This is how LNIB ensures leadership, manages lands and resources clearly and openly. So there's requirements for producing an annual budget. There's requirements for producing an annual report. There's also a requirement that members get access to information when it comes to lands activity. Section 8 deals with dispute resolution. So it outlines a process to follow regarding land-related disputes. Within this section, there's guidelines. The first approach to resolving land-related disputes is supposed to be an informal resolution process, right? And after that, if there's disputes can't be resolved through an informal process, there's an ability for LNIB to create a dispute resolution law, which will require people or interest holders that are in a dispute about lands to follow the process that's defined in the dispute resolution law when it's developed. Currently, LNIB has not developed a dispute resolution law yet. The other option for dealing with disputes is referring the matter to a court of competent jurisdiction, right? And what that really means is, as an example, the BC Supreme Court. And Section 9 is the final one. It deals with other matters, right? It's the odds and ends of the land code and where matters important but not part of other categories are discussed. Land-related insurance requirements is an example. What happens when someone violates the land code? How to make changes to the land code? And how and when the land code takes effect? So that's sort of that is the end of the law itself. It has 9 sections. And with that, I wanted to open up the meeting to see if there's any specific questions or comments, concerns related to the land code itself before we move on to our presentation of the ticketing and enforcement law. Let's start with the first person that announced their name. Rose, go ahead with your comments.
Yeah, my name is Rose Behan. I am a member of Nicola Valley. My dad has passed. And specifically, there has been I need to know the status of the Goaty Road. And I'm just wondering about where it falls within all your frameworks, what it's not, what it is, and the best way to go about finding out the protection of the land, because my dad passed. And I think he was the only living Spahan for the Goaty Road property, and where that fits within this meeting, or how I can find out information. Thank you.
Thank you, Rose. I think if you have specific questions that are not related to the land code, I think you can contact Brandio Flynn. She's our lands manager, and she can provide you with whatever information you're looking for. But I'd like to limit our questions and comments to the land code if possible.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Brandio Flynn, I will be in touch with you.
It's Lorna Sterling that's up next.
I don't know. Maybe this is old news. I was just wondering how does it affect our resources by farming and logging, and do the bans require an okay to start your own business, like getting a loan from the band or get a loan from the bank? Because we spent $80,000 already on a loan on our land. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, yeah. Anyways, is it up to the land code to decide whether you can start your own business on your ranch and on your on logging or any other resource? Like, suppose you found copper on the reserve, would you be able to get the band to okay that? Do they have to okay that, or can you go ahead and do it on your own? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that's an okay. Do you know or not know? So, whether the chief and council have to okay all band businesses on the reserve on our lands, is that it? Because we just went ahead and got loans from the bank when, you know, there was no encouragement from the band at that time or any help as far as that goes. So we got our equipment financed because we had nothing when we started at zero to run the ranch. And it was successful. I think we went ranching for 40 years. So it took us that long to get out of debt, probably. Sorry. Well, you know, we're getting more established in our own business now because my son, well, my family do want to run the ranch, and they might even have enough money to get on their own feet. They won't need permission from the band to start their own business, I guess. I had some more questions, but I already forgot them. I lost my notes. Hold on. I have my notes here. Well, we were the luckiest natives, I think, on the reserves at that time for developing lands, because we went for bank loans, and they approved our loans right away, which, well, my dad backed us up, so he co-signed for all our loans, which really helped. And I guess that's about it for that topic. I'm just wondering what else. Oh, what's that taxation about? Like, we are tax-free right now on all our business. And an Indian Affairs guy filled out my income tax form, and he just put // no taxes on this property here for ranching and all our equipment. So is that something new they're going to do, tax the land or not?
Well, nobody knows. Answering a couple of your questions, if you give me a chance.
Yeah. Okay.
So the land code does not deal with business startups. And,
oh, good. No business startups. I got to write that down. Yeah, because I think my family wants Fred's ready to go away. And like White would say, up in the sky, he's ready to go away. And I think my family wants to start up their own business. Okay, the land code doesn't affect land businesses.
Well, okay, you can let me clarify, Lorna. The land code doesn't impact your ability to start up a business, but if your business is about extracting natural resources, whether it be sand, gravel, copper, or gold, anything like that, then you get a permit, and that permit needs to be approved by the chief and council.
Oh, from the council, eh? Okay. Not that we're retaining anything, but I heard there might be copper up at the Colchana Ranch, and we have a ranch up there. They wanted to, this one fellow wanted to, but he went and died, so we never did find out if there's copper up there on our ranch at Colchana. Okay, they have to go through the band for that. I mean, the land code band, whatever. Band. Okay, that's about all that I can think of.
Lorna?
Yep.
I did want to clarify, despite the fact that you need chief and council approval, your first step would be contacting Brandy O'Flynn so she can help you with an application. So you don't go
directly. Okay. Yeah. Well, there's a few lands in dispute too with us, and we have to solve it soon because Fred wants to make a will. He has a legal will to one land that's on dispute, and I do believe it's from Ottawa. The will is recognized in Ottawa, but there was a second will. We think it was fraud that went over Fred's will. So we have to straighten that out one day. I hope it's successful for our favor, for the children's favor only. But, you know, we're only feeling sorry for those people. They're kind of related to Fred, and we just wanted to help them out. So we just didn't do anything yet with that. So, you know, well, Native people are so poor. They took our land, but, you know, we could have been rich because we had the money to develop it and do more with it and rent it out and stuff. But it's just sitting there doing nothing, wasting away, getting dry, nobody watering it. So I think we should just take it back again. That's about that. And Colchana, Fred paid for that land, and we found out it was our own band land that he paid for. But we fenced it. I rolled the wire, Fred put the posts in, and that hole, it's about 100 acres, so water runs right through it. Colchana Creek runs right through it. So that's the land we want to keep as ours. So it'll be up to the band, I guess, the land code band, to help us keep that property. My son wants it. I only have one son. Okay, that's all my beef. Thank you. They're all sold. Bye.
Thank you, Lorna. I just wanted to answer one of your other questions, too. The land code does not deal with taxation. However, LNIB does tax. It's not really.
Oh, very good. Glad to hear that. Well, I hope it doesn't affect us in the long run, because, I mean, Natives are so poor, like, you know, like bare bones, we have nothing to start out with. And it's so hard for a Native to get even a bank loan nowadays, and long time ago, too. Like I said, my dad, we were lucky he was adopted and had money, and he co-signed for our bank loans. That's why we made this ranch possible. The Lornicle Indian. I don't think there's any on the ranch except the big ranch there that they want from the government. I think it's called Shalush Ranch or something. It's the only other ranch, and it never was profitable either. They didn't know how to raise cows. But we did all right, you know. We kept our head above water and made a little profit at the end before Fred. Well, when Fred had a stroke, we sold out and we made a little profit, but ate it all already. Okay, that's about all. Bye.
Thank you, Lorna. I think Leona Anton, you're up next.
Thanks, LNIB, for providing this opportunity to have questions and starting the process. It was signed off in 2016 and we're rolling into 2020. And so it'd be nice to start rolling out some of the outstanding issues that our people are quite, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of bitterness in the history of how our lands have been handled. And so this is a good chance for LNIB members to participate in developing the law and ensuring that it's done in a fair way and built out by us as a community. So I do believe it's a good direction. And so some of my questions are, out of that map, it shows that there's a number of other communities that are in land code. And so what phases are some of them at? And is there any that you're keeping an eye on that are significantly far ahead in their policy and enforcement and have their land designation and taxations figured out?
Particularly in Surrey, but there's another area.
What's going on? There's actually a number of jurisdictions that have been in this process for quite some time. So they have they've advanced quite far ahead. Some of it have actually been in this process since the late 90s. So they have a number of laws. They ironed out some of their wrinkles. And when we're looking at laws to develop, we're looking at best practices, right? So we look at what other First Nations are developing. And when it comes to which nation we're keeping an eye on, and maybe no one specific. We're just kind of keeping a finger on the pulse of all the nations in BC anyway, and what kind of laws they're developing, right? And the core laws that most nations start off with relate to land use or zoning, right? And that leads or opens the door to developing a land use plan. And other things that come out of that process are just permitting process, right? Permitting processes, right? There could be laws like one of our laws that we have under development that called the Subdivision Development and Servicing Law. Again, that's opens the door for some permitting to help manage the way land is developed and make sure that the development is done in a safe and planned way. The enforcement law was one of the early ones that we selected because it made a lot of sense to us, and we'll get into that with the next presentation. But to sum it up, every law is going to have enforcement provisions. So instead of having these provisions or these section in each law, it makes sense for us to have one standalone law. So we have just one to amend in the future. And we don't have to amend each law when enforcement provisions change. Other laws that come out of BC is with the recent legalization of cannabis. Again, there's other First Nations that have zeroed down on cannabis, and they're looking at trying to regulate use and production and sales in some cases. Most First Nations start off with their key governance ones, like land use or land use planning related laws, and then they start looking or maybe focusing on environmental plans or other things, environmental laws.
So is there a number of in-house capacity that are kind of building an inventory of our resources? Because I know, you know, we have SFE with a number of forest technicians that would be able to help identify, you know, how much timber we have, how much minerals we have, water. And so in order to manage our resources, we have to know what we have first. And so I'm just wondering if there's going to be some internal opportunity to build that inventory. As far as like our forest people, consultants, I'm not sure. I did take a look at what they were doing at the presentation. And so it's kind of, you know, building it out right now. So I just want to be mindful on that, and that we're identifying our spiritual and our hot areas and our water, know what our groundwater is doing. Because then we'll know how to build out our residential. Because I know that Ellen, with Rocky Pines, Goaty, and Zucht, we all suffer from water quality and quantity. And so if we're building out zoning for residential, it's pretty critical that we know that we have water to be able to supply that. So, and also with the, because we're in the infancy, is the federal government funding some of these processes?
Thanks, Leona. I'll try to answer your questions in the order you've posed them. When it comes to resource inventory, I can't say that while I've been here, we've focused a lot on resource inventory. We've pursued some harvesting projects with SFE and developed a revenue sharing arrangement, and SFE has harvested some timber on reserve. What I've heard from our forestry manager is that they don't plan on looking at the reserve for any timber for some time. They're going to let it grow, let the timber grow for a time to, I guess, make sure that the timber is more mature and we can harvest it when it has greater value and when it's more appropriate. When it comes to cultural values, that's really a portion of our land use planning exercise. Part of that process is working with Angie Bain and Gretchen Fox and Urban Systems, our land use planner, and we're identifying cultural values or cultural significant areas. We're hoping to make sure those areas are protected. We're building off past work to do that, and that work is still in process. When it comes to infrastructure capacity, and I heard you mention water, that's something that I guess falls out of one of our laws under development. Our subdivision development and servicing law has a section, it's actually a schedule that describes general engineering requirements for land development. And in that schedule, we're required, or anybody who's developing land is required to determine the capacity to sustain the development they're proposing, right? So there's a requirement to do some planning and some studies up front to make sure that they don't run out of water after they build it. The federal government does provide operational funding, so it's a part of what funds the lands department, a portion of it. We get our other funding through property management activities like lease revenue and other arrangements or land instruments like permits and things like that. And other than that, we do apply for grant funding from the federal government. We've actually acquired a chunk of money for land use planning a couple of years ago. We're still working on spending that and wrapping up our land use planning activity. And with that chunk of money, that's how we got started on some of our other laws, right? So there's I spoke about the land use and zoning law. There's the subdivision development and servicing law. And there's also the environmental management plan or law and law that has sort of been sourced from the external grant money from ISC, Indigenous Services Canada. We've also been able to acquire quite a bit of money from the First Nation Land Management Resource Center for solid waste management planning and some of the cleanup activity that we were conducting this year. This is a lot of money that we utilized to clean up some dump sites. And it's also another source of money that we've been able to secure for developing an expropriation law that we have underway also, very early stages.
So with the LMAC, has that been maximized? Like, is there an opportunity for others to put their application in, or has that been maxed out?
Are you asking if there's opportunities for other members to join the committee?
Yeah.
Okay. There's 7 voting members. The lands manager is a non-voting 8th member. And it's my understanding that there's staggered terms, right? So I think close to half of them had a 4-year term, and I think the other ones had 2-year terms. And probably, when's the next term coming up, Brandy? Next year, maybe? But there might be some vacant positions coming up next year. You have to follow up with Brandy for the specifics, but The idea is to have rotating terms so that there's opportunities for more members and opportunities for council to appoint new members. But at the moment, all of the positions are filled.
Thank you. Just one more question. So with dispute resolution, it seems like it's a very colonial way. And I'm just wondering if there's an opportunity to look at traditional dispute resolutions. You know, we have a lot of corruption that's happened in the past, and the trust isn't there, and it's led to a lot of disputes amongst family and a lot of anger. And I think that with this dispute resolution process, that we really look hard into, you know, how we used to resolve issues before traditionally, and that we need to heal our community, because that really does break us up as a community. And so I'm just wondering if that's been considered.
Yes, definitely a good question. As part of another law that we're developing, we're developing an allotment law. It could be called an allotment and custom interest law. But there's different, purposes for different parts of that law. The main body just deals with general provisions. The first schedule deals with allotments associated with residential houses for purpose of building a house. And the second schedule deals with what we're calling custom family lands, right? This is, I believe, the source of many disputes, the custom interests, the custom ties that family have to parcels of land that are not legal, however they exist. And within that process, we're drafting, I guess the process for considering those applications to legalize those family interests. And within that process, we're going to ensure that there's a way to resolve disputes or disagreements among families, right, if there is some. So yes, definitely, dispute resolution is on our mind. There's going to be some provisions when it comes to custom family lands or custom ties to LNIB lands in the allotment law. And at some point, we'll definitely look at potentially drafting a dispute resolution law, right? So dispute resolution has been high on LNAB's priority, and we've went through some work to develop a toolkit, but I don't think the work's done. We still need to keep on going. There's also, we'll see later in this next presentation, that there's a way to incorporate what we call a community justice process. And you can think of that as another form of restorative justice, right, when it comes to land disputes, if they're associated with land interests or licenses. So there's another dispute resolution mechanism that's going to be built into that also.
Will the community have an opportunity to help build that out then, what that process is?
Yes, definitely. That's the purpose of tonight, right? This is the first of a hope of many, what I'm calling the community collaboration process, right? We want to make sure the community has a chance to weigh in and contribute and participate in the development of our laws, right? And we want to make sure that happens early on, and we want to make sure it happens before it starts entering the ratification process. There's some timelines that we need to meet that are defined in the land code. And these discussions, these meetings like tonight and the in-person one next Thursday, is the first chance that we get to collaborate with community members and listen to their comments and their opinions, and factor in whether they're relevant enough to make changes to our laws or whatever may come out.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'm not sure we caught anybody else's name at the beginning. Does anybody else have any questions or comments they'd like to bring forward?
Oh, yeah, can you hear me? I wanted to ask a question about all our lands aren't CDD. And yeah. Oh yeah, I had a question. Can you hear me then?
Yes, I can hear you, Lorna.
Yeah, I say, we can't afford to CPL all our land. So, well, Fred's been in a stroke for 12 years, can't beat her, right? So does the land code help in any way with that, CPing all the ranches we have? Yes, yeah,
the land code allows us to develop what I talked about earlier, like an allotment law that helps guide CPing land to members, right?
And, we only have it by acre, our housing, you know, our houses. We bought our own house, too, by the way. Disgusting. Okay, guess that's all.
Lorna, could you mute your phone while we ask if there's any other questions? Is there any questions or comments before we move on to the next presentation? We'll take one more, if there's any. Hearing none, let's move on to the next presentation, and we'll have Lindsay Hutchinson up to provide a brief overview through a presentation on the ticketing and enforcement law. This is the first law that we've brought forward for consideration to the community, and we look forward to any feedback you may have on the draft ticketing and enforcement law. And Lindsay has sort of the meat or guts of the law sort of described in their PowerPoint.
Thanks, Stephen. Yeah, so I'll make two presentations tonight. This first one, like Stephen said, is sort of the nuts and bolts of the law, its content. And then after questions on that, we'll walk through a bit of a case study to look at how the law would sort of come into play if ever it was required. And Leona, just another point maybe to your question about how these laws are developed. We work with First Nations elsewhere in BC too. So we have some experience with other nations who've gone through this process before. And we've been lucky enough that they're generous to share what they've learned. And so we often, you know, sort of stand on their shoulders. And then also the Resource Center, that Sean works for, is a great resource as well. They keep copies of all the laws that other nations have done too that are free to access for anybody to look at. And so one of the first things we do is sort of cast the net out and look what others have done and see if there are things, approaches that others have take that sort of suit the Lower Nicola context. So that's generally a starting place for us, if that helps. Right, so like I said, this first presentation is just sort of about the contents of the law. Stephen and I have talked about this. It's relatively simple. It lays out a process, but there are some, you know, other contexts around the law and what enforcement means to people. That can be a pretty big subject. Just our acknowledgement. We're not on the territory tonight, sadly, but thanks to everybody for allowing us to come and share today. This is us, land force people, my colleagues, and David here is with us tonight as well, our principal. So just a note that, you know, David and myself have been working on this law with the land sector staff. So Stephen and Brandy and Chris recently too, and others in the past, Jerrica. And we work also closely with legal counsel. So we are writing laws, drafting laws. We're not lawyers. And we work with lawyers to make sure that what we're doing is in line with what's required. So just sort of a reminder, Stephen spoke about this in his presentation. Prior to Lower Nicola enacting its land code in 2016, the lands were, LNIB reserve lands were managed under the Indian Act. So Canada being responsible for managing lands and responsible for enforcement. So I think it goes without saying that in that context, enforcement's maybe lacking, maybe non-existent. And as a result, I think it's fair to say that there can be the perception that violating laws have no consequences, and that in turn can undermine Lower Nicola's authority to as a government. And so the act of bringing in land code, as Stephen said, it is an act of self-governance. Laura Nicola resumes control of that land, and when you resume control of managing it, that includes enforcing the laws that you make. And hopefully by doing that, it restores confidence in the government and its authority, and ultimately improves people complying with the laws that the community itself is producing. So, like I said, the law is pretty simple. It lays out a process to enforce a law, but ultimately the law is really only one tool in a overall strategy in helping people to comply with all of Lower Nicola's laws. So as we'll walk through in the next presentation, to help people comply with the law that says you cannot dump items on Lower Nicola land anywhere, there's a bunch of strategies that we've been working together on to help that compliance. So physically barring access to dump sites that have been recently cleaned up. So installing some gates is one option we're looking at, putting signs up with different messaging around illegal dumping, monitoring sites. I know Laura Nichols recently hired a security firm who makes regular visits to known dump sites to see if things are going on there. Possibly bringing in a reporting tool so members, if they were to observe illegal dumping, could report that. And as always, educating and informing members about illegal dumping, what it is, how to avoid it, how to properly dispose of items and things like that. So ideally, all those efforts go a long way in making it easy for people to comply with laws. And it's only if those other strategies aren't successful that ultimately the ticketing and enforcement law is something that you need to bring into play at that point. So I think that's an important point for people to understand. So this is just sort of building on that point that prior to having an enforcement law, there's only so many tools that Laura Nicola has to help people comply with laws. Right now, LNIB can inspect sites and monitor, make investigations, so gather data, take soil samples is one example that Laura Nicola can do now, and verbally issue warnings to people and help people understand how to comply with different laws. And often that's enough. Ideally, that's enough to help people comply and people willingly comply. But in a situation where people were still not complying today, prior to the law being enacted, there's really no more tools in the toolbox that Laura Nicola can use to compel people to comply with the law. By bringing in the law, you sort of fill out that toolbox with more strategies for LNIB to use for compliance. So in addition to those steps already that Laura Nicola can take, now the law gives LNIB the power to issue tickets, so formal, detailed, written tickets and notices. Two main methods are issuing a ticket or issuing a compliance notice. So a compliance notice would say you must, take some certain action in order to comply with the law. It puts timelines on that. And it gives people who receive one of those the options to dispute it as well. You know, if you were to have received a ticket in error, then you have some recourse to address that, to dispute that. Other options, again, if tickets and compliance notices don't achieve the goal, then there's other options to take. So things could be referred to a court. Laura Nicola, for instance, could take those compliance measures that they put to someone. If that person didn't take them, Laura Nicola has the power to take them at that person's expense. And if they issued a ticket that came with a fine that wasn't paid, it gives Laura Nicola the power to send that to a collections agency to collect on that unpaid fine. So it just really fills out the toolbox. If one step sort of doesn't achieve the goal, there are other steps that can be taken in, down the road. So just a little on the purpose and the scope of the law. Ultimately, it's about achieving the goals that the community has set. So if clean land is a goal of the community, well, then the enforcement law helps to achieve that goal ultimately. The purpose, this is taken directly from the laws, to enable the fair, effective, and efficient enforcement of all Lower Nicola laws. So there's two ways to go about it, putting enforcement provisions separately in each different law, or one overarching ticketing and enforcement law that applies to all the different laws. So that's the approach that Lower Nicola have taken. And each individual law describes within it what's an offense. So for instance, the environmental management law will say dumping items on LNIB land outside of, you know, a designated landfill is an offense. And then the ticketing and enforcement law would describe how that would be enforced. So like we said, one overarching law, it just avoids having to repeat enforcement provisions in every law. And if you were to do that, there's always a chance that you would not do it exactly the same in every one, and that could lead to confusion potentially. It makes things a bit simpler for staff and for members. There's one law to go to look at all the enforcement provisions. And if there's ever the need to change the law to make amendments, there's one law to do that in rather than amending all the other laws to make a change. So the context around the laws and the authorities, of course, you know, ultimately LNIB's authorities are inherent. After that, as Stephen mentioned, the framework agreement that Lower Nicola is a signatory to, that's what opens the door to land code then. So that process of resuming control of reserve lands and their management away from the federal government and into Lower Nicola's authority. And there are these other laws too that relate to the enforcement law. So in the future, LNIB will be bringing in a land use and zoning law, a subdivision development and servicing law, an environmental management law. And of course, the enforcement law applies to all of them. And I think one reason that we're bringing forward the enforcement law first is that, so it's in place when these other laws come up. If there was no enforcement law already in place, these other laws as they come would need to have enforcement provisions within them. So this is just sort of a procedural way of bringing enforcement first so that these other laws, when they come, they can be enforced right away. So the content, it lays out the roles and the duties of different people. So council, of course, has a role to play. They appoint justices of the peace, designate enforcement officers, and set the amounts of fines or other penalties for offenses. Enforcement officers, they're the people who have essentially authority to enforce the law. It's a general term for different people. So police officers, corrections officers, customs officers are all examples of enforcement officers. And so Lower Nicola will choose who they want to designate as enforcement officers. And in the law, that includes the lands manager. So an enforcement officer is someone who can issue tickets and compliance notices and make offense reports. So that's something if a offense were to go to be prosecuted, that offense report is part of that process. Under the law, they can make inspections and investigations and make inquiries sort of to try and gather information around to determine whether in fact a law was violated. Within the law, they also have certain authorities around entering land and unoccupied buildings and occupied dwellings under certain conditions. So if you were to give an enforcement officer permission to enter your home, then they can enter. Or if they had a warrant or some other authority under another law, could they enter a home?
Sorry, Lindsay, I just wanted to add, you know, it's not just a home, right? It could be a place of business.
Right. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. And Stephen, too, I understand that there's a pilot project for a security firm who's doing some monitoring these lately. And as the last slide says, council has a role in appointing enforcement officers. So they could, for instance, decide to designate that security firm as enforcement officers, for example. Justices of the peace are another role that the law speaks about. They're appointed by council. That's somebody with a legal background. I've heard it described as it is a judge, but of a limited jurisdiction. So a judge that would preside over a hearing for a less formal matter. So, you know, something like illegal dumping that a justice of the peace, if that were to go to a hearing, would hear that. And it's sort of a quicker and less formal method than going through a court. So they preside over hearings, like I mentioned. They have the ability to decide whether a ticket or compliance notice is valid. So if you were to dispute a ticket saying, you know, I received this ticket in error, a justice of the peace would then hear that and decide whether, in fact, it was given to you in error. And under certain circumstances where it's required, they can refer certain matters to a judge. So a court of a greater jurisdiction, essentially. The law also talks about what goes into a ticket or a compliance notice. So both will describe the offense and the date. It will both will contain the name and the signature of the person who issued it. They'll both contain information on how you would go about disputing the ticket or the compliance notice. And they also will make clear that if you do not dispute a ticket or a compliance notice that you receive, then that essentially means you have pled guilty. So if you receive a ticket and you don't dispute it, you have essentially said, yep, I did it. And you pay your fine. A ticket will also contain information on the amount of the fine. And there are provisions around if you pay within a certain period of time, 14 days, the fine is discounted. And if you pay after 30 days, you'll find a surcharge. And it will tell you how you can go about paying as well. A compliance notice will contain additional information on what exactly you have to do to comply with the law, and it will put a timeline on that you have to take that action by. And so other provisions in there, there's information around how a ticket or compliance notice must be served to you, how if you were to dispute a ticket or a notice, how that gets resolved. First, it goes to the lands manager. And then if it can't be resolved at that level, it gets referred to a justice of the peace for a hearing. If you were to fail to attend a hearing, there's circumstances where a time extension could be given or a new date could be given. And then there's also certain provisions saying if you just don't show up because you didn't feel like it, it means you've pled guilty and you have to pay your fine. There's a process, like I mentioned, if someone chose not to pay a fine, Laura Nicola has the power to send that to collections. And also if a person were not to take that action in a compliance notice, Laura Nicola could take the action for them at that person's expense. So they could tow an abandoned car, they could take action, animal control measures, things like that, and send a person the bill, essentially, if the person were not to take the actions that they were meant to. So like Stephen said, there is a provision in there. LNIB has not yet developed one, but they have the ability to bring forward a community justice process or a restorative justice process. So some other means of dealing with enforcement issues and disputes without proceeding through the court. So if there's a traditional process, that could certainly be brought in the future. They just have not done so yet at this time. And so if that is brought forward, a restorative justice process, the law establishes what kind of body would administer that process and who sits on that body and who's eligible to sit on it, how it gets administered, how people who sit on that body will be appointed or removed, and then, you know, the procedures and the powers that body has to administer the process that Laura Nicola developed. So that is essentially, in a nutshell, the content, and I'm more than happy to take any questions.
When is that law? Is that law in effect right now, like if we complain?
Not yet. No, not yet. Maybe Stephen wants...
Does that include old cars that are not being dumped here, but old cars that are just being junked?
It would allow Lower Nicola to enforce other laws that say cars can't be abandoned on Lower Nicola land, for instance. But maybe I'll let Stephen speak about the process to actually bring the law into force. It's not in force right now.
Like, there's tons of old cars out here, but I don't want to enforce the law on him because he might not be happy. But I don't know why he's just junking his backyard with old vehicles. It looks like terrible. Can't drive into his yard even.
Right. And that's certainly not, it empowers the government to enforce laws. So it doesn't empower certain members to enforce laws. That would be on Lower Nicola as a government.
Okay. Elaborate on the lawmaking process. The first step to proposing a law is really a proposal to the chief and council. And that's something that we've done with a number of laws. We propose the development of select laws that we've deemed as priorities, and they've approved us to pursue development. The second step is the drafting stage. This is where the lands team and other consultants like Lindsay and David and our legal counsel work together to create a first draft. And then once we've had a first draft, we think that is ready for community consideration, we circle it through and run it through our Lands Management Advisory Committee. Right, the committee has a chance to review the law, each law in detail, right? And then once we've completed that process, we go into the community collaboration stage. This is the stage we're in right now for the enforcement law, and we're engaging community members and collaborating on how we can make improvements or receive feedback or proceed to the next stage of the development process. So once we've met with the community, heard feedback, answered questions, incorporated any significant feedback, we can then move into the ratification stage. And so at this point, the law is officially tabled at the chief and council meeting, their agenda for ratification consideration. Right? They don't vote on the law at this meeting, but they're officially presented with the draft law. And then also the law is officially deposited with the LMAC chair. LMAC chair is Bill Bowes. He's been able to join us now, I believe. And that's going to happen in the near future. And there's a requirement to have a final public hearing to get last minute feedback on the draft law. And it's important to note that the stage we're in now, the community collaboration stage, is where significant comments or input will be considered, because once we begin the ratification process, it's a bit too late. So we want to make sure that the members have a chance to weigh in and provide feedback, as well as the chief and council, right? We want to make sure the chief and council has time to weigh in, provide feedback, because once we enter the ratification stage, the clock is ticking, right? And there's time frames that are defined in our land code that govern that. So there's about a 21-day window that guides the ratification process, plus or minus, or plus maybe a week or so. Really depends how we roll it out, right, and how the council meetings are structured or scheduled. And once it's been deposited and tabled, the clock ticks, and then the chief and council at a later date will review the law after considering any feedback from the public hearing, and then entertain a motion to ratify the law. So this whole process, at a minimum, could take about 2 months. Once the final draft is developed and it starts to begin through LMAC, it could take longer, right? It really depends on the feedback we get. But at a minimum, there's about a two-month window to begin to get feedback and proceed to the ratification stage.
I have a question. Before we ratify the policy. Is there going to be a timeline that we're going to give our members notification to be able to have time to clean up the unsightly sites of their properties, et cetera? Or once the policy is given, is there going to be a timeline that people have to be able to clean their unsightly properties? We have that policy in place and once it's ratified, is there going to be somebody coming to my door and saying, okay, well, you have to clean up this within 30 days. And then if I'm on like 40 days and they come back and gives me a ticket. Is our members going to have enough time to clean up their sites?
Good question, Geraldine. And the law that we're talking about that will have provisions about unsightly premises, and it'll also include provisions about nuisance situations. That law is called the Community Protection Law, right? And we're not actually going to be finalizing that for at least another couple years, right? Given the COVID-19 and the issues with community engagement that has brought on, we've kind of a backlog, right? So we envision this law, and it's called the Community Protection Law. And I would say that there's going to be plenty of notice to members when this law is being discussed, because it'll impact, I guess, social situations and other issues like unsightly premises, like the cars and the junk. And what I mean by social issues, it will deal with noise disturbances or fighting or partying or things like that. So there's ways to give ourselves more tools to deal with some of those social situations, those parties or fighting in the community or whatever it turns out to be. So I believe there's plenty of notice, and the plan is to pursue a law like that. I think there's a desire to have it done sooner than later, but the reality is that we have other work that we need to complete first.
Okay, thank you.
That goes for old houses that have to be, there are some houses that are condemned, I think, that are still standing, including one old house down there that's on dispute. It's ours, but like I say, those people just took it. It doesn't need to come down, but it's going to be up to the band when those can be enforced, I do believe. Thank you.
Thanks, Lorna. Yeah, we do need to come up with a plan to deal with the old houses. It's on our to-do list, but we haven't got there yet.
I'm just wondering what the rollout plan is going to be. I'm just worried that the sequence of how things are going to roll out may be putting the cart before the horse, per se. And so, if we could have a list of how this is going to roll out in time frames. And then, because I know there was a lot of apprehension on our Facebook page where people feel that this process is being rushed. And so often when you have people that feel like they're pressured, they just shut down. And that's not what we want. We want people to actually participate. And so I think if they know the overarching plan, I think they'll feel comfortable with timeframes and what sequence they're rolling things out. I did see Stephen's presentation to council, and so I understand it. But those that haven't, there's probably a lot of tension and anger and everything that I'm sensing from the community right now.
Thanks, Leona. It has been challenging for us to plan with the COVID-19 pandemic issues and the restrictions that have been in place. But we heard from our LMAC members and some council members some time ago when we asked about law ratification, the consensus was that, well, we don't want to walk into this process until we were able to meet in person, right? And we respected that. And while we've kept developing our laws and other projects, we didn't enter into the ratification process, right? So in late August, the chief and council did open up our buildings, our meeting places to the community public again. And since then, we did try a lands open house on October 17th. And that was our first in-person gathering. We wanted to see what the turnout would be, what the feedback would be. And didn't actually get a lot of people, right? So our next step was to try a virtual. We'll focus on the ticketing and enforcement law. Let's see what the feedback is now, right? And we got about 15 people on the call, which is good, I think. And our next step is next week. I want to make sure that everybody knows that next week we're going to also have an in-person meeting and presentation on the same law. We want to try to give all of our members an opportunity to participate, and we recognize that not everybody is comfortable doing virtual meetings, right? Not everybody has the internet speed or the technology. Not everybody has a computer, right? So we want to make sure that we're giving others an opportunity to participate also. So we have another meeting scheduled in the Chalus Hall next Thursday at 5 p.m. And we're going to, again, like we did at the open house, just make sure we have our social distancing, our masks, hand sanitizer, and other protective matters or measures in place to keep the community safe, keep all of us safe. And again, we're just trying it out. We want to see what feedback we get, what kind of participation, and go from there. My ideas kind of evolve slowly or kind of regularly on how to roll these out. You know, I was thinking maybe we'll roll out with the enforcement law initially, then we'll turn our attention to a business licensing law that helps enable some cannabis-related businesses on reserve. But, you know, now I'm thinking, what about these other projects that have been on the back burner because of COVID-19? Like, we have our solid waste management project that is waiting for community engagement. We have our environmental management plan. We have our land use plan. We have an economic development plan also that I'm sort of collaborating on with Lisa's department, right? So it's a bit challenging, and my ideas are changing, right? So it's difficult to give you a good picture of how we're going to roll out. It kind of depends on how these engagement sessions proceed, right? I want to make sure that people are comfortable and are willing to participate right now, right? And I think in the near future, we could probably roll out a more precise plan, but it's challenging right now still.
Yeah, I commemorate you guys for making efforts. I know it's tough. I know even in the work I do to get community engagement, and it's hard to proceed with the project if you're not getting the blessing of the community. So I understand the obstacles, and I know that all you can do is just trial by error, right? So I'm also wondering, is there going to be a transition period where if we don't have our own enforcers, are we going to be using the RCMP? Because we may be able to amend our tripartite agreement where they're, you know, I know there's incidences where we've had private homes that had tenants that had to be removed, and you know, really the council didn't have any jurisdiction because it wasn't their house. And but yet the tenants were disturbing the peace and other things, right? So I'm just wondering if there's a way of building out our tripartite agreement to kind of kind of fill the gap until we build out enforcement?
It's a good question. Right away, I believe the RCMP can help us with definitely enforcing criminal matters, right? We have our security company that we've hired Secure Guard, and we have Robert Moses patrolling our lands regularly, daily, right? So there's a key connection and communication channel right there. Robert can be a key source of timely information for the RCMP. So when there's criminal matters or issues with keeping the peace, they definitely can step in. I wanted to say that, you know, enforcement is a process, right? It's something that law enforcement, ticketing and enforcement law is a process where we're going to give ourselves the tools to be able to set up our enforcement system. But it's not going to happen overnight, right? We're not in a position where we can appoint a justice of the peace, hire a private prosecutor, and really no other First Nation in Canada is, right? So, but the Resource Center and other First Nations are plowing ahead and trying to do that work and lay the path, right? The RCMP can be more involved in the future. We just need to make sure we build that relationship and partnership and make sure that they're aware of our laws, right? They can help us enforce them as long as they're aware of them. And that's also a part of the task, is to make sure the peace officers, I'll say generally, are familiar with the laws that we're creating.
Bill, I think you've had your hand up for some time.
Sorry for the delay. I was trying to reinvent the wheel. Councillor Bill here, listening to quite a few of your people here, and I jotted down some things that seem very important to our band in community engagement. I don't believe that just two or three meetings is enough, Stephen and Brandy, for I believe we should have a meeting board that shows how many meetings we've had in the past. The subject is so strong and so real and so important that I don't think we can have enough meetings. I am still having a hard time to get a handle on our LMAC board on the overall feelings of how hard we want to push this or how fast we want to push it. I believe there's potential for 4 or 10 meetings from Rocky Pines right all over our entire reserve. Band generals would be amazing if we could have one for this very, very important procedure we're trying to move ahead with. It's probably pretty foreign to a lot of our band members to maybe get a ticket or get a warning or anything. And I know it's all heading in the right direction. Thankful for Stephen and Brandy and whoever else is working on the many steps that we're trying to move ahead with. But I really want more people from the band to hear this, to participate, and to concentrate on what is the best for our band moving ahead, whether it's like cleaning yards, moving cars, building infractions, whatever. It's very, very important. But I'm trusting we'll have more than a couple of meetings, and I don't think it'll end in 2 months, because we don't want to be the board or the employees that push something that the people didn't understand. I'm trusting that we'll be able to move ahead one meeting at a time. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, for those comments. You know, we want to give, like I said earlier, everybody a chance to participate. We want to make sure we have those opportunities, right? And part of our strategy is to do in-person and virtual, right? This is our first virtual Zoom meeting. And, you know, some people aren't comfortable with the technology, right? And like I said earlier, we're going to meet Thursday also next week to have another in-person meeting, right? And while I agree with you, we want to give everybody a chance to participate. We also can't force people to come out, right? There's the people got to choose to and want to, right? And we're going to do our best to provide that opportunity, right? But again, we can't force people to come out and express.
Hope their... the roads are good. Hope the roads are good.
Yeah, me too. Thanks again, both. Leona, Brandy told me that you did write a question in the message field. Could you just read that out? I don't have access to it right now.
So I had asked, where is it? So I think it was answered. We have a Indigenous Judicial Review Panel, and wondering if the person pleads guilty, the Elders Panel can determine the corrective action, as some members may not be able to pay a fine, and or can we have a combination of both, where if it's severe enough that it goes to provincial, and if it's a petty theft or crime that it goes through the current Indigenous panel. But I think it was answered when Lindsay had gone further down into her slides about a possible local judicial review panel. And I asked, because First Nations are federal, how can our case go to a provincial court?
Can you repeat that? It's First Nations are federal, how can it go to a provincial court? Is that what you asked?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe Sean can help me with this, but I'll do my best, right? So courts are set up with jurisdiction, and what our land code refers to is court of competent jurisdiction. And in some cases, provincial courts are prepared and have the capacity to hear certain matters, right? And I'm not going to say I'm completely 100% certain on those issues, but again, perhaps Sean Spears, if you're still on the call, if you're able to weigh in and help with that question.
Yeah, it's a really, really great question. And Stephen got it right. The land codes, as well as the framework agreement, refer to a court of competent jurisdiction. And there's been some questions around whether or not provincial courts can hear these cases. So there was a somewhat recent case out of Comox, where they used their land code in conjunction with a trespass law under their land code to evict some unsavory characters that they were having a difficult time getting off the reserve. And the judge, that was one of the first questions that the judge asked, was, do I have jurisdiction to hear this matter at all? And it was determined that if a community deems that the provincial court is a court of competent jurisdiction to listen to that particular case, then the court will indeed hear that case. So as it stands right now, it's going to be a case-by-case basis. But we purposely funded that prosecution. It was a private prosecution, just so we can start to get the ball rolling on some legal precedents out there with communities using their land codes and the laws that they've developed under their land codes to, in fact, exercise that jurisdiction and make sure that the laws that communities are developing have some real teeth to them. And the Resource Center is continuously looking for other test cases that we can fund another or additional private prosecutions, so we can get some additional legal precedents out there. But really, really excellent question. And the answer essentially is, if the community says we want to allow the provincial court to hear this case and we deem it a court of competent jurisdiction for this case, then they will hear it.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll roll on to the next presentation from Lindsay, and we'll discuss or present a situation or a case with legal dumping.
Yeah, just before that, Stephen, I think someone named Rocky Pines has had their hand up for quite some time as well with a question.
Thanks for that. Rocky Pines, did you want to ask a question or have a comment before we move on? Hello. I think I heard something, but not sure if your mic's
working. Hello.
Hi.
This is Heather.
Hi, Heather.
Can you hear? Okay, Heather. I've got a few comments here. Well, first of all, I'll start with my little list here. I've got a list of regarding ranchers. We're definitely going to need their input, especially with the enforcement. I know at the moment, people get on their little quads and go, and they're not in sync with the ranchers. And a lot of the quads cause more problems than you know, on the ranchers and on their stock and stuff. So I think the ranchers are really going to have to get vocal on this. And we're going to really need a lot of community involvement. I mean, I'm just taking a look at this meeting right now, and it's heavy staff. Very little membership.
Can I have a coffee, please?
And we're going to have to really get with the community involvement right from, you know, otherwise it, you know, none of it might work, you know, if like they said that if you don't answer, you're automatically pleading yourself guilty. Oh, so if they don't want to be involved in this process in the beginning, they're probably not going to want to answer whether or not they're guilty or not. And then, you know, next step is collections, you know, so that all revolves around community involvement and getting people behind this process. And then what about non-band members? You know, if non-band members are, we'll go back to the quads again. If non-band members are harassing the animals on band land, you know, and if they get a guilty designation, you know, how are people going to do collections for non-band members? They might be here today and gone back to wherever tomorrow. So the enforcement is that's real tricky. And when you say once we get to the ratification process, you know, that's pretty well it. That's really scary. That is so scary. You know, that if the community did not get involved before the ratification process, you know, it just spells big trouble, and that worries me. You know, there's so much work has to be done on lands as it is. You know, we're talking from way back. So much work has to be done on lands, and not, you know, not just little old dumping problems, which I understand are getting cleaned up, but you know, so those are my concerns, is that the community has to be involved. They have to be behind this, because if they're not behind this, it's going to be a fight all the way. And as for you know, guilty and going out for collections or something, I wonder what if there are other options. Are there any options that can be used, you know, rather than just, you know, just somebody writing out a ticket and saying you're guilty, and then, you know, the next step is collection. So are there any other options on that? You know, so those are some of my concerns. Hey, thanks.
Perhaps if I could speak to the last point about options. Yeah, and I just want to clarify around guilty. It's deemed to have been, you are deemed to have pled guilty if you pay your fine and a ticket. So if you don't dispute a ticket, if you get a ticket, you've done something, you get a ticket and you pay it, that is essentially saying, yes, I did this. I just want to clarify that's what that means when we say guilty. And I did, you know, the whole strategy is that collecting unpaid fines and issuing tickets and issuing compliance notices are a last resort, and there are many steps taken ahead of time, ideally to help people comply and to make it easy for people to comply. They have to know what the laws are first, for instance, to be able to comply with them. So ideally, the idea and the approach that Laura Nicola's taking is that there are many steps taken ahead of ever having to issue a ticket or a compliance notice or collect on a fine from a ticket that was issued. Stephen, if you want to add to that.
If I could, right? It may sound a little harsh, right? The reality is, though, it's still different than a parking ticket, right? If you pay a parking ticket, you've acknowledged that you're guilty and you parked somewhere you shouldn't have. And if you pay the fine, you've pled guilty, right? It's kind of the same idea. I understand how the language could come across a little harsh, but that's kind of how it works off reserve. With respect to your question about people on quads and ranchers, you know, if we're able to catch them and by any chance serve them a ticket, you know, and charge them, we could also collect that funds by submitting that debt to a collection agency, right? So that would follow them wherever they went, even if they left the reserve. Let's see. I understand your comment, Heather, and I do agree that we have a lot of work to do with lands, and we're working on it, right? And this is just one aspect. The other options that you're asking about, and we totally have other options, right? We just haven't developed them yet. We spoke about a community justice process or board of justice process, right? We can dream up other ways that are more culturally appropriate or make more sense given the charge, right? And we have that ability. It's just not done yet.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay. One of the things that I was when the RCMP were mentioned, that kind of doesn't really sound like a good plan. So, could one of the options be to actually have native police? I know they have native police over in the Lillooet area. You know, they actually have, oh, it's called the tribal council, tribal police, you know, so something like that, you know, might work. And, you know, like you said, you know, we do have to get used to this idea. Get the people behind it, you know, we have to get the people behind it. You know, and, you know, get them to feel pride in our land. You know, so the more work that is done on the land, the more pride these people including myself, are going to feel, you know, the band membership and the people living and working on the Lower Nicola Indian Band and our territories. And I guess that's one of my other questions too. That was for a previous presentation, extending our band lands. But then we're on the enforcement section. Okay, that's about it for my comment on that one.
Thank you, Heather. I think we can definitely look at other options for enforcement, right? There's the enforcement law gives the chief and council the ability to appoint enforcement officers, right? And if there's a tribal police or some sort of organized enforcement body that's already in existence, we can definitely look at that option, right? The beautiful thing about land code is that it allows us to make these decisions, right? We can create our own laws and set up our enforcement mechanisms or tools the way we want to, right? Within reason, obviously. RCMP officers could be involved no matter what the situation, if it comes to a criminal situation or a situation that deals with keeping the peace, right? They're going to come no matter what if there's a serious incident. But we could also have our own people in place, like you suggest, to deal with them if we have that set up. It's definitely possible.
Okay, thank you.
Did we still have that individual under Rocky Pines?
Oh, I'm Rocky Pines. I try to use my bigger computer, but then I had to go back to my little old ratchet iPad.
Okay, great. Thanks, Heather. If we could, maybe we just move on to the next presentation.
Okay. So considering all the things we just talked about within the law, we thought it would be a good idea to take an example of illegal dumping and just walk through how the law would work, would play out in that situation. So recall, of course, that ideally he was participating in illegal dumping. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. So the case study, like I said, to just work through a scenario, how the law would work, how it functions, who has a role in enforcement, and how the process goes. And then two, to understand that a person who has committed an offense or may have committed an offense has certain rights too. Right, so the scenario is illegal dumping. Just back to my point that ideally before we get to the situation of ever having to bring in the enforcement and ticketing law, that certain steps would have been taken already. So a warning has been issued perhaps, or, you know, the government's going to work with the person to figure out how to help them comply. And I, you know, the scenario we're imagining is if all those other steps haven't worked yet. Or perhaps another scenario I could think of is if a construction company was dumping waste and they certainly know better, Lower Nicola, the government might be more inclined to bring in, you know, ticketing and enforcement law on a construction company a lot sooner than, you know, a member who doesn't realize that they can recycle something at the Eco Depot, for instance. So when we talk about enforcement, as we mentioned before, we're enforcing other laws. So somebody's dumped something illegally, what law are they even breaking? LNIB is working on an environmental management law. So that's one law that it could potentially be in violation of, because that law says you must not dispose of an item as garbage if recycling if it's recyclable or compostable and recycling or composting facilities exist locally. So you guys are fortunate enough where you are that there is an excellent waste disposal facility nearby, the Lower Nicola Eco Depot, which takes a lot of items. And if it is in fact garbage, you can't recycle it and you can't compost it, you must dispose of it at a proper facility. So that would be a landfill, for instance, or, you know, the bins that are available in the community. You may only bury, dump, or burn garbage on Lower Nicola land if you have a specific permit to do so. So that's a few of the provisions under the environmental management law, that if you were to toss your old fridge on the side of the road, that you'd be in violation of. Also, trespass bylaw, one exists already. It's in force. the trespass bylaw. Sorry, I forget the year. It's been around a while though. That obviously prohibits trespassing. And did you know that trespassing is not just people? It includes items. So if you abandon something on LNIB reserve land, that item's also in trespass. So there's a violation potentially there under the trespass bylaw, which also prohibits the dumping of garbage. And additionally, the land code has some provisions that talk about trespass. So you're potentially in violation of the land code as well. So a law has been violated. The enforcement law provision comes into play. Just a plug for our solid waste work here. As I think just about everybody knows, or I hope you know, that LNIB has been working really hard over the last couple of months to clean up some of the illegal dump sites around the community. And Chelus Forestry Enterprises were doing that work. And they were able to collect nearly eight tons of recyclable material out of those dump sites. So all that stuff, fridges, old batteries, old tires, scrap metal, all that stuff is free to take to the local Eco Depot just down the road. And so this is, you know, one of the strategies that Laura Nicola wants to use is to let people know that it's probably just as easy to drive it down there as it is to drive it out to an area where people have been dumping stuff. So plug for that. Okay, so a law has been violated, at least one, maybe more than one's been violated, and, you know, other measures to help people comply with taking their waste and disposing of it properly hasn't worked, say. So now the enforcement law comes into play. So we talked about these enforcement officers, and we don't know exactly who yet they may be, but, you know, potentially the security firm, or maybe it's an RCMP officer or somebody else, may enter the site that's unoccupied land. As a note, an enforcement officer must show their identification if they're asked, and they have the authority to inspect that site. So there's three possible outcomes here. They could issue a compliance notice to a person saying, here's, you know, you must take this, you know, old fridge to the Eco Depot within, you know, a certain amount of time. They could choose to do that. They could choose to issue a warning. They could choose to issue a ticket. Perhaps it's somebody that, you know, has been seen to be doing this continually, and maybe they decide a ticket is what's warranted. So we're going to follow the path of a ticket being issued in this scenario. So that person receives a ticket, and there are provisions, like I mentioned, to ensure that ticket is properly served. That person's properly served with the ticket. So in person, they can be served that ticket. Verbally, they can be served if there is like an immediate threat to something like public safety. They could be mailed a ticket by registered mail to their last known address. Or if there is nobody sort of there at the time, no one's been caught per se, an enforcement officer could post a ticket at the site where the action is taking place. If they don't know who's doing it, they could put it in a conspicuous area. So that aside, the person receiving the ticket has two choices, like we talked about. You could either dispute the ticket. Within 14 days, you can take certain actions to say, you know, this is a mistake, that wasn't me. You know, some error has been made and there's a dispute there. If you choose not to, if you certainly did dump your fridge by the side of the road and you decide you're not going to dispute that ticket. So there's two ways to not dispute a ticket. Either you plan to dispute, but you didn't make it within 14 days. So in that instance, you have essentially not disputed your ticket, or you choose to not dispute it because in fact you did do what the ticket says you have done.
Can I say something? That means our oceans are so polluted with those empty bottles and garbage. It's pathetic. They should clean up our oceans before they start cleaning up reserves. I mean, every bit of garbage is out there. My God. And lakes.
Yeah, it's certainly a big problem. So we're going to look at the instance where a person has not disputed a ticket and sort of follow that path. So as we said, if you do not dispute your ticket, either by choice or by the virtue of the time expiring, you are essentially have pled guilty. You've said, yes, I did what this ticket says, and you must pay your fine. So again, there are provisions where if you pay within 14 days, the fine is discounted. If you pay within 30 days, it's the full amount of the fine. And if you were to pay it more than 30 days from when you receive the ticket, you would actually pay an extra bit, a surcharge. And so the ticket will lay out what those amounts are and the timelines. So we'll look now, if you receive a ticket and you do decide it was an error and you're going to dispute it, you have 14 days to do that. So to dispute, there is a fee that must be submitted, and it's not specified in the law how much that would be. That's for Laura Nicola to decide. But you would submit a fee and you would submit your notice of dispute. So some document that's going to say, I dispute this ticket that I got. That goes to the lands manager, who will look at the notice, what you've said. And at this point, there's an opportunity to resolve the issue. So, you know, there was some misunderstanding, there was some error made, you know, that wasn't, you didn't commit the violation. There's a chance here to resolve it. And it's worth noting, if the lands manager at this stage, if it is resolved, that the fee you submitted would be refunded. And so, you know, the ticket would be reversed. If it's not resolved at this stage, the lands manager then would refer that on. So if a disputed ticket can't be resolved, it has to be referred to a justice of the peace or to a court for a hearing within 7 days. So in that situation, the person disputing the ticket would get a notice of the time and the place of their hearing. And once a justice of the peace or the court hears that matter, they would either confirm, yes, that ticket was given correctly and you do in fact owe the fine, or they would modify it somehow, you know, according to the circumstances, or they would reverse the ticket, essentially say, you know, that ticket was made in error and the ticket essentially canceled, is another word there, sort of for reverse. And again, if that were to happen, that fee that you submitted originally when you began your dispute would be refunded to you. I mentioned before, there are certain provisions around attending a hearing. You get a notice of the time and place, and perhaps there are valid reasons you can't attend at that time or place, and it's possible it could be rescheduled. There's certain provisions that talk about those situations in the law. And again, you know, we've talked about this already. If a person were not to undertake the action that they've been given in a compliance notice, Laura Nicola could choose, the government could choose to take that action. So they could go choose to go and pay somebody to remove that fridge that was dumped at the side of the road and send the person the bill for that action. And if a ticket was not paid, Laura Nicola again could choose to send that to a collection agency after 30 days to collect on that fine. So again, a bit of repetition, what we've already talked about, but welcome your comments or your questions.
There's a fellow that collects old fridges and old stoves for money. I don't know his name, though, but he took our old fridge and old stoves out there for money. Like, I guess they call them, I don't know what they call them, I forget. Somebody referred us to, so we got him to take away our old things.
That's good to know.
Yeah, it is good to know, because I sure didn't know where to take any old thing. You know, I mean, giving it to, we used to give it to this old Indian and reserve all our old stoves and stuff, but he passed away now, so he don't take anymore. I forgot his name. Oh, yeah, that was sad. He was just a bachelor.
Hello.
Hi, Heather.
Hi. I'm back to the thing about, because we have people who are band members living on our reserve. We have some people who are not band members living on our reserve, and we have other people who who are, because we do have public roads through our reserve and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that to me is a bit of a an area that I don't know how that would be kept up. But you mentioned something about the band would pay somebody to take away that old fridge, and then the band would have to collect from so-and-so, whoever dumped that old fridge. I think that sounds like a good idea. That way, the band ultimately gets a big bill that they still have to try to retrieve. But, you know, the person who did it, if there's nothing in it for them, and you know they're supposedly guilty, it's gonna lead to a lot of bills on our band membership part, eh? So that kind of gets me kind of wondering about it.
Just to be clear too, the law does apply, you're right, not just to members, but to anybody who's on LNIB land. So a non-member who lives there, somebody else who's visiting, the law applies equally to everybody on LNIB land. And as far as those actions that the government could choose to take, you know, again, the idea is to help people comply. And so what we're really trying to achieve, you know, if the community has a goal of having lands that are clean and free of garbage, then that's the ultimate goal. And there are a number of ways to help people comply with that goal. And it's only if certain steps, you know, don't achieve that compliance, then you have options to take further steps. And so going to the stage of the band choosing to, pay perhaps the person that Lorna spoke about to come out and pick up a fridge and charge them for it is an option. And ideally it's only, you know, used when other options fail.
Yeah, we got paid for our that guy taking away our old stuff. I don't know what he did with it, recycled it or whatever. So that was good. I enjoyed that part. We got a few bucks out of it.
Yeah, it's an important point to make, maybe, that these are options that the government can choose. It doesn't necessarily mean every situation plays out exactly the same. Their options.
Three stars as Carly's former boss, trying to take over the news runs.
They underestimated you. What you've done here is nothing short of a miracle.
When we shot it in August,
Are there any comments or questions from the rest of the guests? Going once, going twice, gone. I'm wondering, Bill, as our LMAC chair, did you want to have some closing remarks? Sorry to put you on the spot, but thought I would ask. You're on mute still right now, Bill. We'll unmute you, unless you can unmute yourself.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I appreciate everyone's comments, and it really does seem like a huge issue, whether it's collecting for infractions or whatever, but I'm sure we will able to work on it, but I don't think I can state hard enough how much we have to get information out, whether it's through handouts to every house or through the newsletter, or if people can attend band generals or whatever. What we're trying to accomplish, we're not trying to be the bad guy. We're trying to make clean, respectful reserves. We don't want that horrendous garbage that was there for years and years. And I want to thank you, Stephen, and crew for cleaning it up. It looks very nice now. And I keep stating to people, like, it does cost money to take things to the dump but it's a lot less than we think it is at times. So it's not a big scary monster out there to throw a couch up at the dump rather than in someone's field. And sure, we're going to need education. We're going to need direction. We're going to need information on how to move forward on this. But in closing, I just want to say I would like to see more meetings. We can't have enough meetings, and we need more input. We have 1,300 band members, and most of the meetings I've been to has been very minute, very small, not too many people. I don't know how we can improve that. But that's a goal of ours, is to get more of our people to understand what we're trying to do. We're not the enemy. We're trying to be a reserve that's moving forward. I thank you for everyone coming, and I look forward to the next meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. That's a good transition. Just to remind everybody that we do have another meeting coming up in person, the Chalus Hall, next Thursday, November 18th. Like I said earlier, we'll practice our social distancing. We'll make sure there's masks available. We'll make sure there's hand sanitizer. Also, we have limits on our people that we're allowed into the building. Currently, we have a 25-person limit. So I imagine we might have... assuming there's participants that are willing to come out, up to 20, 22 people. We'll have some staff present while we're doing the presentation. But we will need to pre-register people so we can manage who's coming and who wants to come, and make sure that we limit the number of people, and so people don't show up and we don't
want to. What time is it again?
Next Thursday at 5 p.m.
Will there be dinner?
No dinner. We're not allowed to provide dinner yet. Unfortunately, the restrictions with COVID has still prevented us from being able to do that.
Okay.
So tell your friends, tell your family. There's another opportunity to learn about our ticketing enforcement law next Thursday. I'm sorry, the 18th, next Wednesday, my correction, my mistake. The next meeting is next Wednesday, November 18th at 5 p.m.
Stephen, with the account of requests for more meetings, are we going to try and put more meetings up, whether it's public or Zoom, for this issue?
Well, like I said earlier, right, we're going to give everybody a chance to participate, right, and I'm looking forward to see what the participation numbers are next week, right? Hopefully, we're going to set out notices again. We're going to anticipate some people to turn out to participate, right? But the response really sort of dictates how we proceed. Ideally, if we get 40 people at least willing to participate next week, we'll have to host another one, right? We can only let half of them in, right? So we're going to look at how things work out next week and go from there.
Thank you.
Okay.
Everyone, Al, Mac, and staff, thanks, Jim.
Oh, sorry, go ahead, Leona.
I was just saying, I was just thanking staff and our consultants and Al, Mac, for all the hard work that you're doing, and council.
Thank you, Leona. So, quarter to eight, I want to thank everybody for taking the time to come out and participate in our first Zoom meeting, and I also want to thank you for your patience while we sort out some of our technical glitches. Over time, we hope to get better at this, and hopefully there's more participation. Thanks again, and we look forward to seeing and hearing from you again in the future. Bye, everyone. Have a good night.
Goodbye.